Welcome to A Cult of Personality podcast, episode 69, published on September 3rd, 2009. I'm honored to say that this episode, featuring an interview with William Kiesel of Ouroboros Press, is sponsored by generous listeners, specifically Steve, Morgan, and Dolorosa. I want to thank you all again for your donations to the show. I greatly appreciate your support. I'm privileged to be able to bring you these recordings and grateful to you for listening. Again, if you enjoy these interviews and you find them useful, then please sponsor an episode by clicking on the donate button in the upper right corner of the Occult of Personality website. If you haven't already, please take a look at the Support Occult of Personality page on the website for a detailed explanation and appeal. Thanks again for your emails. I appreciate your feedback, comments, and questions. If you want to contact me, my email address is rochester92@yahoo.com, or you can click the contact link on the left sidebar of the Occult of Personality website. If you haven't received a reply yet, please be patient. I mentioned last time that Occult of Personality will soon feature a member subscription section that will offer extra recordings. These member section recordings will be in addition to the regular featured interviews that have been and will continue to be provided free of charge. The member subscription section will include extended audio interviews, meditations, and more provided by guests of the show for subscribers. Again, imagine getting extra interviews like Christopher Knowles talking about his in-depth analysis of symbolism inspired by the psychological research of Carl Gustav Jung, or astrologer Lynn Hayes analyzing Sir Francis Bacon's birth chart to provide insight into his life and work, or meditations guided by guests such as Christopher Moores and others, and there will be much more to come. We're also working on making Rising Phoenix Foundation's Inner Fire Journal by David Goddard available as one option for the subscriber section. As an Occult of Personality listener, you'll have a unique opportunity to access some of the most useful alchemical teachings from a true esoteric teacher. As you may recall, I've interviewed David Goddard before in episodes 54 and 62. David's the author of Tower of Alchemy, The Tree of Sapphires, The Sacred Magic of Angels, and The Dragon Treasure of Hermes. Well, David has agreed to make his private monthly teachings available to Occult of Personality listeners. Each month, David Goddard releases the Inner Fire Journal, which is dedicated to the practice of true alchemy and the Hermetic arts. Every month, Inner Fire Journal features high-grade Western mystery teachings, guided meditations, audios, video, and more. We're scheduling the release of the member subscription section later this month, so I'll provide more details in the next episode. Now let's talk about the show archives, which are all the shows up through episode number 38 at this point. Since I had to reconstruct the occultofpersonality.net website from scratch during the month of July, I'm planning on making these archives available as part of the members section. But at some point in the future, there are a limited number of episodes from the archives that will be publicly available for free. I'll begin working on that as soon as the members section is up and running. Now, a few scheduling notes. On Tuesday, September 8th, we'll publish the first of our two-part interview with Mitch Horowitz, author of the excellent new book, Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. After that, we'll feature an interview with Auriel Defenestrate Bascule, who is also presenting at the upcoming Esoteric Book Conference. And that will be followed by part two of the wonderful interview with Christopher Knowles. Our intro music is by Hypnosis. The background music is by the band Darkfold. The outro music is a song called LVX by Agrippa 93. Check out their website at agrippa93.com. Now, in episode 69, we're joined by William Kiesel, the proprietor of Ouroboros Press, and organizer of the upcoming Esoteric Book Conference. Ouroboros Press has published a number of historic esoteric source texts, including the Picatrix, Turba Philosophorum, the Heptameron of Peter Albano, and the Arbitel of Magic. You can find the Ouroboros Press website at www.bookarts.org. William has also organized the Esoteric Book Conference that will take place in Seattle, Washington on September 19th and 20th. You can find conference details at the website esotericbookconference.com. William and I talk about esoteric antiquarian texts, the concept of a book as a talisman, the work of Ouroboros Press, and the upcoming Esoteric Book Conference. I want to welcome to the show William Kiesel. Hi, William. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate you having me on the show, Greg. I've been a fan.
Oh, thank you very much. It's absolutely my pleasure. I've been an admirer of your work as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got started in publishing and esoteric books?
Sure. Well, you know, I've always been a book person. I started collecting esoteric books at a pretty young age, and I was interested in working in the field, and I was, you know, I think, you know, Adam McQueen was really one of my early inspirations, because he really spent a lot of time in the archives and pulling out these older alchemical classics and really just bringing them to the public eye. And so I was collecting works like his, and you know, I always received catalogs, antiquarian catalogs from Jocelyn Godwin and some of these other folks. And so I've always sort of been a collector myself and interested in the literature. And, you know, living in Seattle, I was born and raised in Seattle, and it's really a great book town. And so I've been fortunate enough to, you know, be around books and be around people who are making books. And I was an apprentice at Joel Radcliffe's Ars Obscura Bookbindery when I was quite a bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
And he was another really important sort of inspiration for me. He encouraged me to start publishing. You know, I was interested in these things, but, you know, when I was learning how to bind books with him, which was great, I really enjoyed the process. I found that the research involved in finding which texts were important and why was how I ended up spending most of my time. So I found myself in, you know, collections around the country just trying to do research on these things, and I really get a lot out of that side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the, you know, the first title that Ouroboros did, the Picatrix, really for me it was just a matter of wanting to read it. And the Warburg had done the German and the Latin editions, really quite nice critical editions, academic editions. But they were never going to do an English edition because they figured that only medievalists would be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a medievalist, you either have German or Latin, and that was sort of their reasoning. I don't have German or Latin, so I thought, well, if I'm ever going to read this, I'm going to have to do it myself. And Joel Radcliffe actually was instrumental in getting that going originally. So, yeah, it's sort of just been an ongoing interest of mine, and over the years I learned different aspects of the trade. I've been an antiquarian bookseller for 15 years, and I've spent time, you know, studying letterpress printing and binding and paper making. And, you know, the earlier aesthetic of the Renaissance and the Middle Ages was really what I found myself attracted to, which is why I was interested in the construction of books and how the typesetting was accomplished, and it really helped to inform, you know, my sense of tradition.
And yes.
I think that's why I've focused on earlier source works in the Western esoteric tradition, because of the materials in which I've printed them in, but the original texts themselves, which have had influence on later writers and practitioners.
As much as I enjoy the work of a lot of modern day teachers and writers, to me there's really no substitute for going back to these type of books.
It's true. It's true. You know, the contemporary avant-garde art movement wouldn't be what it is without the classical artists that they're sort of standing upon their tradition. You know, people like Van Gogh or Austin Osmond Spare, these different artists certainly had their own innovations, but they were also classically trained, and they knew about the masters that were doing work in previous eras before them. And I think it's important to know what our roots are, because that's where we get our nutrients, and that's how we have the strength to continue to grow in a tradition. I think that in terms of, you know, continuing that tradition, there really are a lot of contemporary scholars and practitioners working along the lines of that tradition, and it's great, but I think that the amount of material, like you say, during the Renaissance, there was such an explosion of things being published, even though it was a hard time to be publishing materials like that. It's incredible the amount of information that's really there if you can find it. And, you know, there's plenty of museums and archives that hold the material, but it's not easy for people to get into if they don't travel or if they're not accustomed to working with institutions of that kind.
Mm-hmm. Ouroboros Press has really brought forth a number of books, publications that are really legendary and of great stature and very well respected, but not having really been available.
Yeah, well, I think that in the modern era, the level of attention to education is a little different than, say, during the Renaissance or even the 19th century. You know, during the 19th century, you had orders like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and most of the people involved in that were scholars, and they knew Latin, they knew Greek, they were familiar with the classics. That was just part of the course for their education. And today, it's not as much of a focus unless you get into the classics in you know, college or university level courses.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost an afterthought, as opposed to just being part of a regular education. So that may have a hand in it. I'm not sure.
Now, you're obviously very familiar with the ideas and symbolisms of alchemy and the Western esoteric tradition in general. Would you tell us a little bit about your experience in that realm?
Well, initially, my interest in alchemy stemmed from the art itself. There's a number of beautiful illuminated manuscripts and emblem books that appeared during the Renaissance. A particularly fine example of is that well-known book by Michael Meyer, Atalanta Fugiens,
mm-hmm.
which has 50 alchemical emblems along with epigraphs and pieces of music. And the art itself drew me to it, and I was studying things like Erwin Panofsky and the other iconologists, sort of taking this historical approach. But I found that the Hermetic tradition is expressed in that tradition itself, in that art movement. And the more alchemical books that I came across and read and cross-referenced, the more interesting it became for me. I did eventually meet some people who are doing some of the alchemical operations in the laboratory setting, which I've done a bit of myself, but mostly I'm more studying the very historical side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, having done some of the experiments in a laboratory setting, it's interesting to note how close some of these operations were described by the mythological and artistic expressions of alchemical texts.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. And I'm always intrigued by the way it mirrors the spiritual alchemical practices as well.
Yeah, there's certainly a connection between the practical and the mystical side of alchemy in the early days of alchemy before, you know, people like Robert Boyle wrote The Skeptical Chemist,
mm-hmm.
and sort of founded the movement of empirical knowledge, which tends to let go of the more mystical or abstract side of the art and focusing more on the scientific chemical side, which of course brought great advances in chemistry.
Right. Could you tell us about some of the specific books that you have published? You mentioned the Picatrix, but there's several others that deserve to be mentioned, I think, in a conversation, because they're all just true treasures.
Well, sure. Well, I followed the first volume of the Picatrix by the Heptameron of Peter Abano,
mm-hmm.
and which often was traditionally published with the Arbitel of Magic. They often came together in manuscript and printed form, and the Heptameron is a collection of conjurations of the seven planetary angels that can be found in Agrippa and other ceremonial magical texts and grimoires, and it's a text that you see referred to again and again in the literature. And when I did it, there was no edition currently in print, although you could find the text online. And I found that there were many people who wanted to have a copy of this book in their library for use. And I really enjoyed working on that one because the typesetting was a really fun project to do, to try to give it that feel of a grimoire of its day.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really one, you know, next to the Key of Solomon, it's really one of the most popular grimoires to have been passed around.
Mm-hmm.
And following that, I did the Turba Philosophorum, which is originally an Arabic alchemical text that was translated into Latin. The edition that I put out is the Arthur Edward Waite translation, because he had occasion to consult several different manuscripts. There's two variant manuscripts for the Turba Philosophorum, and there are some differences. Now, the Turba is a collection of dialogues that take place between some of these more well-known and also some very obscure alchemical authors throughout the tradition. And it's very likely that these are spurious attributions. There seems to be a tradition in esoteric publishing to attribute books to famous authors like the Key of Solomon, and or Moses is often given attribution to magical texts, Hermes Trismegistus, these sorts of things. And I think that naming these names is a way of tying the text to a tradition. And you can see in the Turba Philosophorum dialogues that a lot of the ideas being expressed by these different authors are being discussed and sort of experimented with in a theoretical way. It's a lot of confounding passages and a lot of illuminating passages in the Turba Philosophorum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really a fun one put together. That book, incidentally, was the beginning of the Festina Lente series, which is a sort of an imprint of Ouroboros. I'm going to be releasing a series of alchemical texts, and that was the first among them. There's also going to be editions of Fontina Chemica. There's another alchemical anonymous text that has 14 treatises on the first matter. Others in the series will be two books by Michael Meyer, The Jocus Severus and Lucis Sirius, which were, one of them is a dialogue between plants, animals, and minerals, the three worlds of alchemy, discussing which among them is the most useful and popular, and during the conversation, of course, expounding the Hermetic tradition. And the other one is the Jocus Severus is sort of like the Conference of Birds written by Attar, where all of these birds get together and they discuss who amongst them is the wisest. And this is judged over by the phoenix, and they decide that the owl, who is the representative of the alchemical art, is the wisest of them. Pretty witty texts, actually, and full of alchemical gems.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and then really the one that I think is going to be the crowning achievement of the series is Elias Ashmole's Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum.
Ooh.
We're doing a corrected and rectified edition of that collection of English alchemical poetry. So that's taking a lot of time and careful editing to get the text in alignment with the original errata sheet that Ashmole left behind.
Okay. Now, that's, of course, a very highly prized and treasured book, so I'm sure it will be a wonderful addition to anyone's library.
Oh, yes. The broadside, the letterpress-printed broadside.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just wonderful. I mean, of course, along with many others, that's probably my favorite of all time, but it's just an excellent edition of it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really a hugely influential text to the tradition, more so than I think a lot of people realize. The often recounted as above, so below comes from the Emerald Tablet of Hermes, and even though there are several translations of this available in various editions of books, they tend to get buried in those books and maybe not looked at as closely as they could. So I thought if I did a broadside that could be framed and mounted, that perhaps people could see, look up and see, those words and let them influence them in their own libraries or laboratories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I haven't seen a broadside or edition of it that looks quite so nice with the alchemical emblem at the top.
Oh, they came out really great. They're printed on a nice Arches paper stock. It's letterpress printed, so the typeface is pressed into the paper. Same with the engraved emblem at the top. And the typeface was designed by an American type designer named Bruce Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Centaur. And it's a nice piece of printing, and that text was worthy of having that kind of attention.
Absolutely. So I'm curious, as a publisher of fine books, and I think what could be rightfully be called ancient texts, what are your thoughts about what seems to be a movement away from printed texts towards more electronic mediums? I know I myself, as a book lover, really have difficulty reading things from a computer or from any sort of digital device, and I really like the way a book feels in my hand, but I don't know if I'm in the minority there or not.
Well, I feel the same way you do, Greg, and we may be in the minority in terms of the world, but I don't think we're in the minority in terms of the kind of material that we like to read. I found, you know, in my years of being a bookseller that people who are interested in studying occult texts also tend to be people who collect books. Whether that's, you know, whether they collect fine books or just books for reference, they still like to have the hardbound, the actual copies in their hands when they're reading, because, you know, studying these kinds of texts take time, and it is hard on the eyes to stare at a computer screen for an extended period. I think email is a good example of the mentality that's been generated from the digital medium. You know, for instance, today we can send an email and it can appear almost instantaneously. And there's this sense of urgency that comes with that. This idea that you have to respond quickly because it came right away, and the response can be just as instant. And whereas, you know, before the internet, people would receive a letter, they had time to think about how to to reply, so they could really give a measured response. And I think that the quality of communication has suffered because of the faster medium. And, you know, when you have texts like say, you know, the Mutus Liber, but the Turbo Philosophorum, or I'm working on a Giordano Bruno book right now. It's just not the sort of thing that you want to read online, you know. I think it's a different world, and I think that, again, it harkens back to that idea of tradition, because in the Hermetic tradition, there's always been book arts involved in publishing and making this information available to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Michael Meyer book I mentioned earlier, Atalanta Fugiens, is sort of an early multimedia project, you know, where you had music, poetry, and imagery all at once. And that's not too far from what the World Wide Web is trying to be. But for more detailed texts and texts that need to be referred to often, I think that having the actual book itself is more useful and practical.
You know? Yeah.
And certainly magical texts and, you know, grimoires in particular, they tend to have this sort of sense of being magic objects themselves.
Mm.
They're very talismanic in that sense. You know, Joseph Peterson recently released a new translation of the 6th and 7th books of Moses, which is a beautifully done edition. And I believe in the front of it, a lot of the early printed editions of the 6th and 7th books of Moses had this sort of verse in the front that said that whether you read the book or not, just having it in your possession, you know, is a safeguard in your life and brings you luck and things like that. And there's a lot to be said about the archetypal idea of a book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely think that's true. I'm glad you brought up the talismanic aspect, the energy of a book itself, all of the time and care that went into producing it, a work of real craftsmanship that is unfortunately less and less available and maybe even less appreciated in our mass-produced consumer culture society that we currently live in.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that because of the diminishing interest, that the level of production for books is going to have to increase in order to continue to exist. Because the idea that, you know, mass market paperbacks are convenient and consumable items, but so is reading a digital text. And so why should we, you know, deforest more trees consumable goods that are just going to be, you know, recycled, when they could actually be made into things that could last for hundreds of years, and, you know, held to be art pieces unto themselves. You know, I don't know about, you know, other people, but I myself, when I walk into a room that's filled with books, I find it to be a very pleasing environment, as opposed to walking into a room full of, you know, digital screens or, you know, LCDs and that sort of thing. So really I think there is a physicality to it that lends itself to a more reflective, a more thoughtful and studious attitude. You know, in the early days when during the manuscript tradition, when books were written, they were written because they were a means of remembering. You know, a lot of the early you know, instructors and philosophers would have to remember long dissertations and texts and epics, and it was, you know, a means for them to remember their thoughts and to remember their ideas. And so once these things were written down, someone could actually possess another person's thoughts. And you know, early manuscripts are really viewed in this way, and I think that that's part of the reason why this sort of, you say, talismanic, you know, what would you call it, talismanic aura, you know, is associated with these texts. It's because they were thought of as the thoughts of the authors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, originally these things were passed down, it was the oral tradition, but, you know, texts are also a kind of oral tradition, especially heretical texts during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. They would have to be passed around to people who were trusted, not to turn you in. So often there was a lineage going on there between practitioners, because generally people who had those texts were interested in studying them or working with them if they weren't, you know, the authorities who were throwing them into the fire.
It's not only were these texts dangerous to possess and shared only with trusted associates, but oftentimes the author or authors would put in blinds to hide the true operation or the true intention or meaning behind it. Have you encountered a lot of that as you publish these books and go through and put them together?
Well, of course, some of that is copyist errors, but often what you'll find is that the book was written with the intention that it would be utilized by someone who was already a practitioner of the discipline that the book related to. So, for instance, in the grimoire tradition, you know, you often only find just the barest essentials to complete the operations, and it was assumed that you had all the prerequisites already. You already knew how to construct a magic circle, or you already knew how to make the implements needed for the operations, or already understood the astrological considerations that needed to be applied. And so sometimes the books and manuscripts will seem fragmentary, and it was just assumed that the information was already being conveyed in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it manifests itself that way, and in terms of, you know, people trying to put in blinds, I think that it just depends on the text and the tradition. I mean, some people say, for instance, you know, with the regard to the tarot, Eliphas Levi is often considered to have put in a blind in terms of the order in which the tarot keys were arranged. I can't answer that since I'm not Eliphas Levi, but I suppose it's possible that, that those kinds of artifices have been enacted because it implies that there's hidden knowledge, mm-hmm. secret knowledge, and I think that in itself is part of the tradition, this idea that there's something beyond the surface. I mean, esoteric has to do with the inner side of things, as opposed to the exoteric or outer side. So, if they straight away state that things are deliberately being communicated in obscure ways, that's, in a way, it's their way of saying, look deeper in. Mm-hmm. Deeper past the surface. And it's the same with any text. I mean, you know, they're dead letters unless you can receive the spirit that they're intended to communicate.
Right. And I know even modern teachers do something very similar where they'll describe something but talk about that you need to experience this yourself in order to understand what the words really mean.
It's the difference between knowledge and belief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you can believe a person when they tell you what it's like to be stung by a bee, but knowing what it's like to be stung by a bee comes from actually being stung.
Right. And higher states of consciousness are even far more difficult to convey using words than physical ones. Physical states, you know.
It's true, but we persist in attempting to do this.
Yes.
I think that this plays into the idea of the talismanic book, because what that is saying is that although the book itself cannot convey the knowledge that's trying to be communicated with it, it's the key through which that knowledge may be had.
Mm. Indeed. And I think that is wrapped up in the whole desire for people who study esoteric philosophy and practice to have books of this nature in their hands and to meditate on them and work with them.
Indeed.
Which brings up another topic I wanted to get to today, which is the Esoteric Book Conference that's coming up in September 2009. If you could tell people a little bit about that.
Sure, that's going to be in Seattle, September 19th and 20th. And there's going to be a two-day conference focused on esoteric book arts, and there'll be authors, artists, publishers, and bookmakers who in the field of esoteric publishing in some regard, whether they're making the books, whether they're writing the books, publishing the books, illustrating the books. And we have speakers coming from three continents to give presentations from a wide variety of fields. We've got Darcy Kuntz coming, who's with the Golden Dawn Trust, Richard Kaczynski, who's well-known in the Thelemic scholarly circles, Robert Ansell with Folger Limited,
mm-hmm.
Is going to be giving a talk on talismanic publishing, and also Austin Osmond Spare and his life.
Mm-hmm.
The folks from Scarlet Imprint are coming over, and they'll be talking about Babylon and also the books that they've been publishing. They're been quite active in the last couple of years, publishing several books, and it doesn't look like they're going to be stopping anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
The Mannion Press will be there. We have Thomas Carlson from the Dragon Rouge is going to be speaking on Kabbalistic subjects. Michael Staley from Starfire Publications will be there. He's going to be representing the of Kenneth Grant. Amy Hale is going to be giving a talk on the surrealist and occultist Ithil Colquhoun, who wrote The Sword of Moses, which is a biography of MacGregor Mathers. Brandy Williams is giving a talk on the Chaldean oracles, and Christina Oakley Harrington, the proprietor of Treadwell's in London, will be also speaking about grimoires. And we have Daniel Schulk coming from Zone on Publishing as well. It's going to be a good time, and you know, there's been similar conferences like this in the UK, and we just thought it was time to have one here in the United States, and the response has been really good. We're going to have a really nice lineup of presentations, and then there's going to be a free book show, a book fair, where there'll be numerous esoteric publishers as well. You know, of course, Ouroboros will be there, Night of Pan Books will be there, Folger, Zoanon, Scarlet Imprint. John Coughlin from Waning Moon is going to be there with his hand-bound books. Ajna Bound will be there. Ars Obscura Bookbinding will be there. Mannion, Starfire, Golden Dawn Trust will be there. And J.D. Holmes, the antiquarian and publisher, will be there as well. So it's going to be quite a collection of authorities on esoteric publishing and writing and scholarship, and it's going to be the first one, and we're going to get together and talk about grimoires and talismanic texts and secret societies and other esoteric bibliomaniacal things. And we have a website where all the information is. It's just the esotericbookconference.com. And yeah, I've been really, really happy with the lineup. I think that, you know, occult publishing is a pretty small field, although growing. You know, there seems to be a renaissance of it right now, and it seemed like a really good time to just get folks together, many of us have corresponded over the years. Some of us have met, and we thought it'd be a good time to just get together and rub elbows a little bit and to just, you know, get the word out about the different publishing that's going on in the world right now. You know, I was interviewed, for a local literary blog in Seattle recently, and about the conference, and they noticed that one of the descriptions for the talks mentioned the word antinomian, mm-hmm. and they wondered what antinomian meant, and I was explaining to them that it had to do with the idea of, you know, rejecting the idea of a morality, but in this case from the standpoint of religious dogma. And you know, this happens all the time in occult circles, because a lot of these texts, especially the grimoires, employ linguistics that the church used. I mean, you've got these long versicles and these prayers and invocations and conjurations, and where you're asking for God's assistance to invoke an angel or to conjure a spirit of some kind, and so there's always going to come into play these different perspectives on, you know, what's proper and what's not proper, and again, you know, it can be quite a question to answer, you know, given the centuries of you know, debate about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very good point. So I'll definitely add links in the show notes to the Esoteric Book Conference, and I will post this prior to that. Is there a cutoff date for tickets or anything?
Well, there's not. You can get tickets right at the door, but there will be limited space for some of the events. There's day tickets available, there's weekend tickets available, there's a deluxe ticket available that includes a evening entertainment and a sort of a banquet feast. And But then there's also the art show and the book fair, which are just open to the public. So whether you come for the talks or just to see the books, then, you know, there's lots of options.
Excellent. The last question that I had was, do you have any advice for people who are thinking about getting into esoteric publishing in general, or esoteric writers who are looking to have books published in this type of fine style that you and Ouroboros Press typically does things?
Well, I think they could do no better than to come to the Esoteric Book Conference, where they'll have at their disposal all of the contemporary publishers who are doing this sort of work right there.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be able to see the works that they produce, the quality of the works that they produce, the kinds of works that they produce. You'll get to hear them talk about those works and how it is that they've decided to choose these things. And it's a great opportunity, because in just one place you can talk to, you know, 14 different publishers, you know, who are working now and have been working, you know, for the past decade or more in publishing these kinds of texts. So I think looking at the kinds of materials that are out there and communicating with people who are working in the field is the best bet, because they're the ones who have sort of laid the groundwork and can really, you know, save you a lot of trouble by making these kinds of recommendations. And it's good to, you know, like I was saying before, when I was talking about the fellow from Mexico, your enthusiasm and your desire to accomplish something when put into action is really the thing that's going to make anything happen. You know, there has to be work put behind the idea. And, you know, here's an opportunity with the conference where you can see and meet people who are working today in this field.
That's excellent advice. So I want to thank you again, William Kiesel of Ouroboros Press. It's been delightful to speak with you, and always appreciate the fine work that you do.
Thanks very much, Greg.